You might have noticed that Pat and I are pretty fussy about our finances and our investments.
Yeah, a lot of junk doesn't make it past our bullshit detectors. But one thing that we've both used for many years is ShareSite. It records all dividends, franking credits, transactions, and performance easily in one place.
You can generate reports for income and capital gains, which makes tax time super easy. And ShareSite is completely free if you have 10 holdings or less.
So we've partnered with ShareSite to help support the podcast and provide all our listeners who upgrade to a paid plan a saving of 33% off the annual plan price. If you start with a free plan using our link, you'll still get that discount if you upgrade to a paid plan in the first 60 days.
Just head to ShareSite.com/fire and chill to get started.
Welcome to the Fire and Chill podcast, a collaboration between Dave from Strong Money Australia and Pat from Lifelong Shuffle, where we're going to have regular conversations about fire, investing, and living your best life. So today we're here with episode 10. Where we're going to talk about the misconceptions we see people making about the FIRE movement, different worries people have, and things that all the naysayers and haters have to say, of which there are surprisingly quite a lot. So as with anyone who's trying to lead a slightly different life or do anything different, there's always a bunch of people standing nearby, pitchforks at the ready to kind of cut you down and, hey, you're not allowed to do something different. You need to follow this uniform path. You need to conform. We just want to have a talk about some of those criticisms, let's say, and even some of the questions and worries people might have about the FIRE movement and try and clear some of that up as best we can.
Yeah, like you said, like even people who are new to the whole financial independence scene probably have their own questions or their own maybe worries that we'll try and clear up today, or things that they're not quite sure about. We'll cover all those today.
It's a pretty funny one. As soon as you try and do something different, people interpret that as you're criticizing whatever it is they're doing. It's a weird psychological thing.
Because I suppose with your doing something different, people are forced to reflect on what they're doing. And so your actions make them question what they're doing.
Well, and by leveling criticism at what you're doing, it kind of reaffirms in their own minds that they're not making the wrong decision, or they're not, you know, acting irresponsibly themselves. They need to attack you to justify to themselves why they're doing what they're doing. Look, we're all human. Like, we all have these weird thought patterns, but yeah. It happens.
There's definitely some strange assumptions and some strange, I guess, accusations that are made. So we'll have some fun diving into those in a minute.
Yeah.
The first one that comes to mind for me is that financial independence only works for high income earners. So what do we think about that one, Pat?
I don't know if I have much credibility here because I do consider myself to be a high income earner. But I also think that this is a completely nonsense argument, because even though I'm a high income earner, I'm living on a very, very small proportion of my income. So even if I was an average income earner, I would still be saving 50, 60% of my income. As you get up into those higher tiers of income, the tax eats away more and more of it in any case. So even though the before-tax income seems so much higher, the after-tax income is not proportionally as high as the after-tax income of someone on an average income.
Wait, just hold on a minute, Pat. I'll just get my little violin out for you.
Hey, I'm not complaining. I'm more than happy to keep earning as much as I'm earning and try and earn more and keep putting more of it away. I think I did actually do a blog post a long time ago where I compared my spending to the poverty line spending, and it wasn't that different. Like, it is more from memory, but it's not a huge proportion more. So
okay,
make of that what you will.
That's interesting. So I guess for high income earners, like you said, it's obviously easier if you have a higher income, but that doesn't mean that it's not possible for anyone who's on a middle income or even a lower income who learns to manage their money better than the rest of the population. And it might surprise some people to know this, but the median, not the average, but the median full-time wage in Australia is actually around $78,000, and that was in 2018, so it might be a little bit higher now. And that's from the Bureau of Statistics. So that's actually a very good wage when I think about it.
Yeah, and just...
And you didn't believe me, Pat.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, just so we don't get tripped up, I actually didn't believe Dave when he said this, because I always hear the $50,000 to $60,000 amounts being thrown around as the median income. But the key differentiator here is that we're talking about the median full-time income as opposed to the median income, including part-time and casual workers. So the median full-time income actually is $70,000 to $80,000 per year. And so I think if you are going for FIRE and you can probably first off need to find full-time work.
Well, you're already semi-retired otherwise.
I mean, if you're working less than full-time, you're kind of, yeah. If in your mind what Dave just said kind of sounded odd or not accurate, it's probably because we're differentiating between not all incomes and full-time incomes in this case. So median full-time incomes.
And so from any income that you're making, we've got to remember that it's not necessarily how much you're earning, but it's how much that you're able to save that matters. And so you can go back and listen. We've talked about this before, so you can go back and listen to our episode, which is episode number 4, where we talked about savings rates and how important that is to your ability to become financially independent. And in that one, we also break down the time it's going to take you to retire early between now and that date, depending on how much of your income you're actually able to save and invest.
Yeah. And in no way are we trying to say here that, you know, everyone has the same difficulty in reaching early retirement. I think it's clear to everyone involved that if you are on a high income, that it's far, far easier to save a higher proportion of that income for saving and investing. Only thing we want to say here is that it's not just for high income earners. There's still a path to financial independence for most people. It's just a matter of priorities and getting that savings rate up based on your priorities.
And so if we think about it, there's probably a spectrum of difficulty, we could call it, where people have a much harder time of this than others, and it will depend on your income and your household situation. So the easiest is probably couples who are working full time, who have no kids. They'll have very high household income and no dependence as such. And then the hardest situation is probably like a single parent household or a couple where just one spouse is working and they might have multiple kids. That would be probably the hardest type of situation for them to make progress towards financial independence. And then there's a whole bunch of people who will be in between those endpoints of easy versus difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose this is just another sort of lesson, like when you're in your earlier years and you don't have those extra responsibilities placed upon you, it's far easier to reach for something like financial independence, like dual income, no kids, especially once you start, if you're a career-oriented professional, those first couple of years as a graduate or something, you're not earning a whole lot of money, to be honest. Just as a side note, sidebar here, people like to have a complaint about, oh yeah, you're on a high income. Like in the first few years out of uni, you literally get paid rubbish. Like absolute rubbish. As an engineer on a worksite, you maybe get paid half to one third of what the tradespeople and the laborers are getting paid.
Wow, really?
Oh, it's rubbish. I know graduates who are like on $40,000 to $50,000 a year, right? We're talking like just brushing that minimum full-time wage. What is it? Like,
yeah, just I think the minimum wage is full-time wage is about $40,000 a year or thereabout.
Oh yeah. And so we're talking about even professionals for the first 3 to 4 years of their careers are far below the average full-time income. It's only once you start getting into your late 20s, mid 30s that you really start to reap the rewards of what you've sowed like 10 years ago at university with all that debt as well. So,
and the funny part is that people manage just fine on those wages because they have to. They manage just fine, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And if you take someone like myself and you average my total income from, you know, being 18 years old to being now 32 years old, you'll find that my average income over those 12 years is probably below what would be an average Australian income. Mm. Because, you know, someone out of high school who just gets into, you know, proper work, full-time work and does a bit of overtime here and there, as I still do as a professional engineer, they're earning far more over the course of the first 12 years of their life than any professional out of university earns the first 12 years of their career life.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that before. That's kind of like my situation, I suppose, where I didn't really finish school and then I started full-time work when I was 18 and just did that with overtime for the next 10 years, essentially. So yeah, that's essentially the comparison of my situation versus yours that you're describing.
Oh yeah, I think if you took your earning years from 18 to 30, 32 or whatever, and you compare it to mine and take into account that I had to spend an extra 4 years at university. So I was just scrounging around doing casual work in those first 4 years while you were earning a full-time income plus overtime. And then even when I got out of uni, I was certainly not earning as much as the tradespeople and the, you know, laborers on my work site for several years before I finally started earning equivalent to what they would earn, I would say. And only very, very recently have I think started to earn more than professional tradespeople on my work site. It's not all sun and roses just because, you know, you come out of university and you're not considered a professional yet, really. It takes long, several years before you start earning those big bucks.
All right, so what about the next point here? We've got
about that segue.
Damn it, Pat, we're only on the first point. We already got lost.
Yeah, where was I going with this? Sorry.
we were just covering that this only works for high income earners, which is obviously nonsense.
Oh yeah, it's such nonsense. And I think where I was going was use those early years in your life to put away money, because it's far, far easier than when you've got kids and you might have a partner who's not able to work full time and all of that business and paying for all those extra expenses. Make it easy for yourself, basically.
All right, so let's move on to the next, shall we call it a complaint? Or an assumption.
We covered this last time, didn't we?
We've covered this before, but it's a common one.
Yeah, FIRE means you can't buy a house. No. You'll have to rent forever.
You have no security forever, because obviously if you want to buy a house in Australia, it costs you an arm and a leg, so there's no chance you can be financially independent, is there?
No.
Surely not.
Definitely not. Well, I've heard the opposite argument as well, quite comically. You can't be FIRE unless you own a house.
I've got it from both ends. Yeah. You can't consider yourself financially secure unless you own a home that's completely paid off.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, let's just cover quickly. We've done this several times before. If you choose to rent and not to buy, then that's fine. You can still be financially independent.
It's okay.
All it means is that instead of having money locked away in a house, you have that same amount of money in other investments that then produce an income to pay the rent.
Exactly.
It's almost completely equivalent, except for emotional factors.
So our message here with housing is that really what we'd urge you to do is simply to keep the cost of your house reasonable, and too many people end up overextended with a huge mortgage and then spend their whole career paying it off. So then they feel like, well, of course, this is impossible if I own a house and have a big mortgage to pay.
Yep.
So really, if you just keep that shit pretty reasonable and under control, then you can still make progress financially. Yeah, and there is no law that says you have to buy a house. So feel free to continue renting if that's what you prefer. But either way, you have a choice over the matter. You don't have to choose. I mean, you have to choose one or the other, but don't feel pressured to choose one over the other.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you want to spend a large amount, like on a house, that's totally fine, but it might just take you a bit longer to become financially independent.
Yeah. Key message, don't spend more than you can afford on what is essentially a lifestyle item.
Yeah.
You choose to either buy a house or rent a house. Now, you can also pay too much rent for a place to live in. Like, I'm in a one-bedroom apartment at the moment. I could probably rent a nice condo on the beach and have nice views of the water, but then I would be overpaying for my housing. And that will send FIRE back several years or decades, as well as buying a house that's too expensive. Just different ways of paying for housing, and you can overspend in each of those ways as well.
So it's just about keeping it reasonable, whatever you choose.
Choose what you can afford, exactly.
All right, what about the next one? The next thing I see bandied about as a reason or an issue is that to pursue FIRE, you have to make major sacrifices and you can't really do anything that's enjoyable because you just have to stay home and save as much money as possible so that you can then retire early. What do we think about that?
I don't know. I was thinking about this, and maybe this is where FIRE bloggers and podcasters might seem a bit extreme. Not all of them, of course, but there might be this perception that you have to cut everything everything out so you can really drive that savings rate up and retire early.
Well, Pat, that's what you're always telling me, mate. We've got to get this savings rate up and, you know, you're driving this anxiety.
Well, maybe. What we definitely try to get the message out there is make your priorities and spend according to those priorities. You know, that could mean a whole bunch of things. It could mean going out to dinner every week with your friends, whatever. If that's important to your life, then that's important to your life. But you have to draw the line somewhere and you have to be reasonable about it and do stuff in moderation. You can't just have this endless tap of, oh, I'll just spend as much as possible and just keep doing all these other, you know, little things that I think I want to do. It's not like that.
I suppose we can flip it on its head and point out the fact that sacrifice is a perception in terms of you're making a major sacrifice every day because you're giving up your life to go to work every single day. So that's a sacrifice in itself. So there is no way to, everything is a trade-off, you know. You're trading your hours and your life away to be at work, and you can trade your money for other things, and everything comes with a trade-off. If you save today, you have more in the future. If you spend now, you have less in the future. And it's not a one-way thing, you know. There's different ways to look at it and different ways of perceiving it.
Yeah, agree. And I've said this several times before, you have to choose a lifestyle that's actually going to be achievable long term. You can't think that you're going to scrounge for 5 to 10 years and that's going to work for you. You'll probably just drive yourself insane and quit. In any case, balance and moderation is supposed the name of the game.
Part of this point that you can't have an enjoyable life comes from a bit of a underlying fear or an underlying assumption that the pursuit of fire costs you living the good life now, that you have to wait until later kind of thing. But that's not really true. I mean, like, there's so many enjoyable activities that we can do. Some of them cost a ton of money, some of them cost no money at all. That means things can be expensive, but they don't have to be. And if they don't have to be, that means the idea that a nice lifestyle costs a certain number of dollars is nonsense, because there's both options are equally valid. There's plenty of enjoyable things we can do that cost nothing at the same time as there are things that cost a fortune.
Yeah, you're definitely fighting up against the embedded assumption here that you need to spend money to have a good life. And any foregoing of spending money is sacrificing a good life to save, which is, of course, complete nonsense, right? Because you can just make that argument forever, like spend more and more and more, and anything you're not spending on experiences or goods is sacrificing. Well, I mean, does that argument end?
Yeah, you're right, though. Yeah. So if we just stand back for a minute, like, is enjoying nature expensive? No, it can be, depending on where you go to enjoy nature, but no, it doesn't have to be at all. What about reading books or playing sports or like spending time with family or friends? That gives you like a lot of enjoyment and can cost very little to no money. Or you can go on a family holiday to Hawaii and cost you $10,000, you know?
I want to go trail biking and jet skiing. How about that?
Well, you can, but you're going to get the same, you're going to get enjoyment from that activity, just like someone who goes for a regular mountain bike ride or a bike around the lake or whatever with their friends. You know what I mean? So you're both getting enjoyment. One spends heaps, one spends not much.
Yeah, exactly.
So the point is that no, you do not have to make major sacrifices and you can still live an enjoyable life. And an enjoyable life doesn't necessarily have to cost a certain amount of money.
No, and I think we just, get rid of the embedded assumption that spending more equals a better life. That's the embedded assumption there, and that's nonsense. But of course, to not repeat ourselves too much, that doesn't mean you stop spending everything and you have a good life. That just means act in moderation, spend where your priorities are, spend intelligently everywhere else to try and get the maximum out of life while not being crazy. Move on to the next one.
All right, about the next one. So the next one, we've kind of talked about this before as well, that having kids means financial independence is impossible. Ooh. So we don't really want to be the guys on here with no kids saying how it's, you know, easy to retire early if you still have kids. So,
but we are those guys.
No, so we'll just cover this point briefly so we won't spend too long on it.
By the way, did you see, like, after we did that first interview with Aussie Firebug, like, one of his comments went absolutely crazy about this topic on his Facebook page?
What was it?
You didn't see that. You, Matt, and I, like, started mentioning having kids and fire in our very initial interview before we started this podcast, and people did not like that.
Of course they didn't.
And there were arguments on both sides, of course, but it blew up on Matt's, you know, Aussie Firebug's Facebook page, like, in a big way.
It's a pretty contentious issue.
Yes.
That's part of the point, though. You get parents arguing with each other about how much it costs to raise kids and whether it's still possible to build a financially strong life for yourself if you do have children. Mm. So the fact that there's parents arguing with each other about these points means that most of it comes down to your choices.
Yep.
And that it can be expensive or it can also not be that expensive. Not that it costs nothing, but it doesn't have to blow your finances way out of the water. It can, but it doesn't have to.
And that is what, God forgive me if I get this wrong, but I think NatSem has released figures on this. Basically says the exact same thing. Like, different parents spend different amounts. You can spend everywhere from $0, i.e. you only spend, you know, handouts that the government gives you on your kids, all the way up to like $200,000. And so they've studied this over a long period of time and came to the same conclusion. Like, yeah, it depends on how much money you have and how much you want to spend on your kids.
I've had people even arguing with each other on my own blog about this issue, you know?
Yeah.
And some are saying, you know, because you get childcare rebate and all that, it doesn't cost much at all. And they can't understand how some parents say that it's so expensive. And others are saying, you know, if you calculate the foregone income of maybe one parent staying home or working part-time, then it costs a fortune.
Well, I think I said this before as well. Like, a lot of those figures amortize the cost of a bigger house into what it costs to have a kid, which I suppose is fair enough from that point of view. But I've probably already considered the costs of a bigger house in my overall plans. So it's not an additional cost that I haven't considered. It's just, okay, I've already considered the cost of a bigger house. I'm just going to not do it in Sydney. It's going to be somewhere else where it's cheaper.
I don't really like that argument of, you know, including the bigger housing costs, because most Aussie households have like at least one or two spare bedrooms anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like, unless you're a couple who are living in a one bedroom place, which is probably not that many couples, you already have space for a kid that you're paying for.
Yeah. You just don't have the kid yet.
Yeah, but you're already paying for it.
Yeah.
But then you can't chalk that down to, oh, my kid costs this much because of this bedroom. So it's a portion of our rent. No, you were probably already living in a place with an extra bedroom anyway.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, it sort of explains where some of those crazy figures that you see on the daily news and stuff come from. It's like, it's a whole bunch of things. Like, they're not taking into account the government handouts. They are taking into account amortization of additional house living space into those figures. They're probably taking into account lost income from one of the partners having to stop work completely or stop work for a period of time, or childcare costs, whichever way you want to play that. Those are all the figures that go into having a kid, but they don't necessarily apply if you think about how you plan to live your life anyway. As I just said, I'm probably going to get a bigger house anyway down the track, whether I was planning to have kids or not, because I just want my own space, but I just don't want it in Sydney. And to the lost income, I wanted to go down part-time anyway, me and my partner, or stop work, which is why I'm doing this whole fire thing. So I can't really count the lost income into the cost of having a kid, because I was going to lose that income anyway.
And so that's a good point. Like, if people are young and starting this financial independence journey now, if they work hard and build their finances up for the next 5 or 10 years and then choose to have kids, while they can probably cut down to like part-time work or maybe even no work at the same time, they'll be able to kind of semi-retire at that point and they'll have a much less stressful life, way more time with their kids, and it will be, you know, it'll be such a better outcome when they do eventually have kids. So they're in a real advantageous position if they were to start now and build up their wealth before having kids.
Yeah, yeah. Front load the whole working career as much as possible.
Mm.
And then, you know, ease it back. But I suppose the point here is that you can't trust the figures the headline figures you see online and on the news, because they're baking all of these things into it. It's not really transparent what they're baking into those figures.
Mm.
And so it gives this warped number that isn't reflective of what it might cost you.
Yeah. And so even if we kind of just be conservative here, we can just safely assume that it's going to cost you more than not having kids. So if it's an additional expense, just means that this FI stuff might just take you a bit longer. But it's definitely still possible. I mean, I know some people here in Perth who are retired and in their 30s, and they both have kids. So it's definitely doable.
Cool.
Next one.
This is kind of the same of the early one we did. It's... You must live an anti-consumer lifestyle. Nice things are not allowed.
So some people think that we have to forego like the niceties of the modern world, you know what I mean? And we must live this super Spartan type lifestyle too. We can't enjoy the things that other people enjoy, but we still get to have smartphones. We still get like safe cars. We still get to live in a comfortable house. We still get abundant entertainment. We can go out to eat. We can do some travel. It's just that the secret ingredient that nobody even thinks about. It's this crazy concept, Pat. You might have heard of it. It's called moderation.
Oh, man.
Does anyone do that anymore?
No. It's just not allowed.
No.
Well, like, you also get, like, ridiculous arguments. Like, this is a real discussion I've had with people in the past. It's like, I've got this smartphone here. It's probably 3 or 4 years old in terms of the model that it is. Mm. Like, I didn't buy it 4 years ago, but the model is probably, like, 4 years old. And people will make the argument that you are now taking shitty photos and you're ruining your memories because you don't have the best camera on your phone.
You're ruining your memories.
You're ruining the capturing of your memories. And by all intents and purposes, this is probably like a 90% awesome phone camera or 95% awesome phone camera from about 4 years ago. It's just not at that cutting edge, you know, iPhone 12, Samsung Galaxy Note 10 or something quality. It's like literally the difference between my phone and those phones is probably 5 to 10% in terms of the camera quality at most. But as technology advances, I think people focus ever more and more and more on fine, nuanced details and just the most minor of differences to justify the, you know, the progression.
Yeah. Nobody sees the bigger picture.
And the bigger picture is just completely lost. And it's, you see it all the time. And it's just crazy.
So what you're doing, Pat, is really you're robbing your children and grandchildren of more happiness because you're too cheap to upgrade your phone to take better photos of your family.
Maybe, I mean, yeah.
I mean, there's no end point to how far you can take these kind of arguments that newer is better, that more is better.
No.
There's just no end point, man. They're like, this shit just goes on forever.
Yeah, it does. And I've seen the same thing happen with TVs. Like, TVs' picture quality has been getting better and better and better. Like, undoubtedly. Like, it's just, it's become amazing. But, like, if you compare a TV from 5 years ago to a TV today, the difference in quality, like, if you stand back and you actually assess it, like, unbiasedly, it's not that bad. Like, you're still getting a very, very decent high-quality picture. But, again, as technology advances, to differentiate between this year and last year, you have to focus on ever and ever finer details. And it just becomes crazy, yeah.
The way I think about it is that if you're to upgrade something every year, whether it's your car, your phone or your clothes or something, think about the waste. Like that thing has just been produced for you. You're going to throw the old one out or whatever. Mm. It's just such a waste of materials. And think about the landfill, and it's just insane the amount that you would, if you're going to follow this constant replacement model every single year for the things that you own, because you want to be on the cutting edge of technology, like you said, that just becomes to me, it becomes almost like an ethical issue of being super wasteful and using way more resources than you need to. Like, I get that other people want to follow that approach, but I don't like it just from that kind of standpoint. It just seems super wasteful. Even if it costs no money at all, it just seems wasteful from a resources and planet point of view.
Yeah.
What are we trying to say? I guess we're really trying to say that you can still enjoy the perks of living in a rich Western country like Australia, and that you can still enjoy these little doses of consumerism from time to time, but they're just really little hits of novelty. They don't really add long-lasting value to your life in the way that other things do. They don't have a ton of meaning attached to them. And so it's still an indulgence that we can enjoy from time to time, but you want to do that in limited amounts because we know that consumerism and buying stuff and all the rest of it is addictive and doesn't tend to make us any happier in the long run.
No, definitely not. If you're following on the cutting edge, then you really are just paying a lot of money for just minute increases in functionality or quality. Things do change like a lot over periods of time, but year to year, products are almost identical.
Yeah.
And it's crazy to update a lot of products on a year to year basis.
Mm. All right. What's the next point, Pat?
Oh.
You had this one. I'll let you take this one.
Yeah. Let me take this. It's immoral to stop working. Our duty to society is to be productive and pay tax.
So the point there, people sometimes make the point, like, you're going to retire early and then what? Don't you have a duty to society? You're going to drop out of being a productive member of society and you're just going to, you know what I mean? You're not going to be part of the system. And so we have a duty to be productive and to pay tax and to be part of this kind of social system that we've built for ourselves, the economy and all the rest of it. So I think you had some, when your ABC article came out, Pat, that you had some back, wasn't there like, not a rebuttal, but a guy wrote an article after yours that was kind of like deriding the idea of retiring early because of this kind of point?
Yes, yeah. He made a lot of very funny points, I'll say. just trying to remember back now. The crux of the article was that you live in a society and you're not contributing if you're not paying tax.
Yes, you're not contributing.
First of all, I just probably want to point out that the vast majority of people are net neutral or net negative when it comes to their tax contribution to society, when it comes to their monetary contribution to tax. I'm talking, again, don't quote me on these figures, but like only 10% of people or 20% of people pay all the tax. Everyone else gets more back in benefits than they actually pay out in tax.
And so people might be wondering where that kind of statement comes from, but would it be from the pension as we get older and from healthcare throughout our lives?
Something like pension, healthcare, family tax benefits, all sorts of subsidies. The vast majority of people actually take far more from the system than they put in. And then what we call the net taxpayers are in the top, you know, a couple of deciles of income earners through their lives. This article is actually having a go at probably 80% of people, but let's forget that. Let's now just have a few rebuttals myself, maybe. Like, if you're going to equate your contribution to society on the amount of tax you pay, then that's just a very sad way to look at the value of human life in society. It's kind of a bit depressing.
Well, yeah, that's the way I think of it. So we're not allowed to stop work because our job is essentially to work as part of society. So then are we really a free person or are we essentially a robot or are we like a slave, you know? If that's the value of our life, to contribute to a bigger system, to be a cog in a machine, what's the point of that?
But it's not even to just contribute to a bigger system. It's the equating of paying tax to your contribution to the bigger system. It's like the argument is there that because you're not paying tax, you're not contributing, which is, I think, is nonsense. First of all, everyone contributes to this whole system, whether they're a net taxpayer or not. Like, this whole system will fall apart if we didn't have all of those, you know, 70, 80% of people who are not net taxpayers. Like, they're working as well and they are contributing to the overall system, even if the amount of tax they pay is less than what they take out. Everyone's a sort of cog in this system, regardless of the physical amount of money they put into it. And second of all, just following on from that, if I stop work and I stop being a net taxpayer, then it doesn't mean I'm not going to stop contributing to society in some productive way. There are plenty of people that pay no tax and contribute to society in productive ways. And that's just something else that I can do. But let's say theoretically that I don't end up doing that and I just want to, you know, mooch off the system for the next 60 or 70 years. Well, first of all, that's impossible because as an earning investment income, I still have to pay tax, just like anyone else who earns investment income. And second of all, being financially independent means that you're at least completely taking care of yourself. So even though you're still benefiting from society, you're not actually pulling from government assistance programs to help support yourself.
Yeah, you're not living off the system. You're a self-funded investor, essentially, from your own work and your own savings. So do you really owe anybody anything?
Yeah, which is actually an ideal that is far more than most people will achieve by the time they end up in retirement. Most people will be pulling a pension. And I don't think a pension is in my future. I don't think it's in yours, Dave. If you look at it from that perspective, we're actually, you know, far ahead than the vast majority of people because at least we're going to be self-funded retirees.
So you could say it's a bit more noble than it is selfish.
I mean, I don't want to act like I'm doing this just to be noble.
But you're...
Obviously, this is a self-interested thing.
Yeah, of course,
thing.
But you're hardly going to be mooching off some system for the next 30 years.
No, I do hope to be productive and I hope that my contribution is not measured in tax dollars by the time
and
I die.
Hopefully people can realize that the value of a human life is more than just being part of a big machine and paying tax.
Oh, fuck.
But we're probably talking to the people who totally understand that already, Pat.
Yeah, well, I hope so. And
like, another point that the outsiders sometimes miss is that basically everyone who's becomes financially independent at a somewhat early age goes on to do other productive things. They'll probably go on to do other, maybe some type of other work that they enjoy. Maybe it's unpaid, maybe it's paid, or they might start a business or do all sorts of things. They don't just, like, they're not just going to sit around and watch TV. So they'll still end up being a productive member of society. That might just look a bit different than it did before. I do have a hammock, yeah. But I actually don't spend very much time in there.
Well, I mean, I think it's idiotic to equate being a valuable, productive member of society with the amount of tax dollars you contribute.
All right, so let's move on to the next point. And the next one is that retiring on an investment portfolio like we are is not sustainable, and that when the market crashes, we'll be in struggle street and we will need a job, but we won't be able to get one. So the whole idea is kind of reckless and not sustainable. How do we feel about this?
Oh, God, this is a frustrating episode. Just having to deal with nonsense point after nonsense point.
Isn't that our job?
Yeah, okay, I suppose so. Is this our contribution to society?
Maybe. But the Fire and Chill podcast is currently not paying any tax, so maybe not.
No. Well, it's not earning anything either, so.
Is it a net benefit or a net negative for society?
I'll let you decide. So yes, when the market crashes, the investments will take a hit. However, the 4% rule isn't, you know, resting on a knife's edge where a slight little knock will knock it over. It's actually made to deal with the vast majority of market downturns that have occurred in the past. When the market crashes, unless it's a type of market crash that has been the absolute worst that has ever been, and or maybe even worse than the worst market crashes that have ever occurred in history, then chances are that it will survive those market crashes just fine and will continue to grow, because it's actually a very, very conservative rule of thumb. That 4% withdrawal rate, or 3.5% if you want to be super conservative, is actually made to deal with the very worst market downturns. In fact, it's made so robust that in the vast majority of cases, like 90% of cases, that 4% rule leaves you with double or even more than triple of what your original portfolio amount is at the end of the time period that's being examined, either 30, 40, 50 or 60 years, because that's exactly what happens when you're conservative. Because you're dealing with the worst case scenario, if anything other than the worst case scenario eventuates, you end up with far more money than you ever need.
So this is brought up a bit, you know, you see stories like, when the market crashes, all the early retirees will be back to work, you know, they'll be begging for their jobs back.
Did you beg for your job back, Dave, in the recent market downturn?
No.
Did you change anything at all during March, April, or May?
No, I didn't change anything.
Oh, wow.
So, but I guess the point is valid that our investments will definitely take a hit from time to time. So let's say we have a crash that is worse than historical crashes have been, and that maybe the downturn lasts much longer than previous downturns, which sounds kind of funny to say since we just had the fastest recovery from a bear market, I think, ever in the last couple of months. But let's just say the future is crazy. The opposite of that. This does mean that we'll need some sort of backup plan or some sort of strategy to cope with a situation like that. Like most of us do, you've probably got some ideas in mind, Pat, of what you would do in some sort of a disaster downturn scenario.
Yep.
If we just start from a couple of these ideas, there's a couple of levers we can pull, like earning more, spending less, etc. So we could earn more by trying to get some sort of part-time job or renting a room out in our house or something like that. And we could also spend less money. The FIRE crowd is typically very good at ratcheting down their spending if they need to. And I actually did a post about this called Financial Independence Backup Plans, where I look at, okay, let's just say something happens and our investment income falls by, I think I used like 40% or something as the example. And what I found was I looked at our spending and where we could quite simply or quite easily save on what we're currently spending. And I think I found that by moving to like a cheaper rental property and a few other things, like maybe not traveling for a while and cutting back restaurant spending and stuff like that, we would be able to reduce our annual spending by like 20 or 30% without too much without too much drama, and that will go a massive, massive way into plugging whatever gap there is between how our investments are doing and how much we need to live on.
Absolutely, yes. And even though a few episodes ago I said that I don't keep an emergency fund and I'm 100% in the stock market, if and when I do retire, that will definitely change. I'm not going to keep 100% in the stock market. I'm going to have an emergency fund plus, or maybe a bond allocation too. I haven't exactly sorted that out in my mind how that's going to look. I am reasonably certain that I will have some defensive assets.
So some pile of cash or pile of bonds that you can use when stocks are getting hammered, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. If you take into account the reduced spending, plus you don't take from the risky part of your portfolio, you start taking from the safe part, so bonds or high interest savings account, you can really make that extend out a few years to tide you over during those really bad market downturns.
Let's just assume that we run out of cash and all these things don't work, and we eventually have to sell down more of our stocks, and then we eventually run out of stocks because our portfolio goes to zero or something, but then we end up with superannuation later on that we can also access. And that'll most likely be another few $100,000, which will be a huge help.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then already this scenario is a bit ridiculous. But then if we just take it one step further, there's also the pension as a backup, I guess, income stream in the absolute very worst case scenario where all of these things don't work.
Oh, yeah. If we enter like a 1920s style depression or even worse, then there are multiple backup plans to tie you through. And if you do enter a situation like that, then you've pretty much got no one in society has prepared for something like that. So it's not like you're in any special bad circumstance compared to anyone else that you could have otherwise prepared for.
Exactly. You'll still be in a better position than the majority of the population.
Yeah, exactly.
People like to almost complain about how miserable the pension is, but really it's actually, I don't agree with that at all, because it's actually quite generous. I think for a couple it's around $35,000 or $40,000 for a couple that's on the pension. That's also indexed to inflation, so that increases every year. So if we have an income stream that's like 35 grand a year or 40 grand a year, and that increases with inflation, that's like having a $1 million share portfolio that increases with inflation, and you're living off 4% a year.
Yeah, and is that for a home owning couple?
Yeah.
If I owned a home and I was making 40k a year of the pension, I'd be made.
Yeah, I think it's 30, 35 or 37 or something like that, 35 to 40. That's very good, man.
That's far more than I spend. But maybe they have extra healthcare costs and stuff. So, you know, we'd have to look closer into that, I suppose.
But I mean, if we think about it right now, the pension is therefore worth about $1 million.
Yep.
As an income stream, if we were to put a value on it.
Yeah, if you try to buy an annuity or something.
That's pretty generous.
Pretty crazy. And I think you're still able to have like a stockpile of cash and get the pension, aren't you? Like there's an asset floor $100,000.
Yeah, you're allowed to have a bit of assets as well on top of that.
Yeah, so you can still have assets and get the pension, and and your primary residence isn't counted whatsoever. So crazy.
So I mean, there's so many backup plans. Could probably do a whole episode about backup plans in the future. So many little levers that you can pull if you're in some disaster scenario. And as we've mentioned before, like most people will still go on to earn some sort of income after they do become financially independent. So the fear of running out of money is typically like unwarranted, really.
It's academic.
Yeah. People just like to worry, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. I'm still in accumulation phase. I worry sometimes too. You want to be really robust before you pull that pin.
Maybe I'm just a bit more
relaxed.
Relaxed or reckless, maybe.
Well, because you're there.
But like, there's so like, many levers.
Oh, this ain't so bad.
Yeah, there's so many levers you can pull afterwards, man.
Yeah, but one of those levers probably isn't going to be getting a high income job in engineering.
But you won't need it because you live on not much. You've got investments, you've got some cash.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
There's so many different things you can do. So you don't need to go back to some high paying full-time job. That concern is like rubbish.
I get it though.
Why would you need to go back to a six-figure job?
Not that you need to, but if you're going to like look across your entire life, you want to leverage your high income earning potential as much as possible, because
that's if your goal is to accumulate the most amount of money, not to enjoy the most amount of years from your life. Because every year stay at work, you're sacrificing a year of your life just to accumulate more money.
No, you're right, but it's a trade-off, because I can either like work an extra year now to build more robustness into my plans, or face the risk of needing to get, you know, 5 years of crappy part-time work or something. I don't know. You're right. It's probably unnecessary. You feel more secure just knocking out some of those high income earning years.
Yeah.
Just being a little more robust in terms of facing those risks.
But that can also lead people to, I guess, chaining themselves to that one more year. It's like there's like a name for it, even one more year syndrome. Like, oh, just a little bit more and I'll be even more safe. So it's this like obsession with safety and covering against all sorts of risks. And you know what I mean? People continue to trade their life away for a little bit more cushion, a little bit more safety. So, I suppose I look at more at the freedom foregone than the potential risk or inconvenience, I guess, later on of having to find a backup plan.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, how about this little nugget here, Dave? If everyone was fire, the economy would collapse.
So this one's actually, I mean, if we think about it, it does actually have some merit. If everyone stopped buying shit they didn't need, our consumer economy would quickly start to break down. Logically, that makes sense.
Isn't that exactly kind of what's happening now with coronavirus? It's like a lot of people have stopped, not everything they didn't need, but a lot of discretionary spending in some industries, obviously hospitality.
Some, yeah.
And so it's having an effect on the economy, even just one industry of or two industries of vastly reduced spending.
I guess my thoughts on this is that there is basically zero chance of this ever happening. And the reason I say that is just the idea that everyone will just wake up one day and think, oh, I'm going to be a bit smarter with my money now. I'm not going to waste on this and this and this. I'm going to save and invest and do all these healthy things. It's almost the same argument as someone saying, well, what if everyone just woke up one day and started to just went on a huge health binge and just decided not to eat any junk and everyone was going to be super healthy and exercise every day. And you know what I mean? Like all the fast food places would just shut down super quickly. All the junk food companies would go bankrupt. That hasn't happened and it won't happen because people don't there's not going to be some mass realization. Everyone's going to wake up one day and do exactly the same thing. People don't change that quickly and people don't find change that easy to do. So when people do make decisions to change their habits or to change their lifestyle, it tends to happen very slowly and a little bit at a time. And so even if we accept the argument that a growing number of people will start pursuing financial independence, those changes would occur so slowly over such a long period of time that it wouldn't have a dramatic effect or an immediate effect on the economy. It would happen gradually and the economy adapts to whatever spending is growing or shrinking inside the economy. So those industries will rise and fall depending on how we're spending money. And the final point is that like the fire crowd still spends money. It's not like we just spend zero money. It's just that we spend money on different things and in different ways. Yeah, I don't know, man.
There was an argument when the Industrial Revolution happened and when automation started taking over that people would have to work less and less as time goes on. And it just never happened because instead of working less, people just started spending more and more on stuff they didn't need. This has been something that people have sort of expected to happen for a while, but it just never took place because no one expected the whole machine to be so effective at convincing people to spend more and more.
We just keep finding more things that we just create new desires to fill, essentially.
Yeah, but like you said, if spending did shift, then it would happen so gradually that new businesses would pop up to take advantage of it and the economy would change and it would just be a shift of spending rather than a, you know, overall reduction. Maybe it would be a reduction.
But it wouldn't be mass. Sure. It's not going to be mass immediate collapse, you know, because people aren't just going to wake up and, right, let's all do this today.
Yeah, exactly.
I've seen just that point you just brought up, Pat. About what was it you just brought up?
Automation and
the idea that we were going to work less and less over time because of technology and increasing wealth and all the rest of
that. Yeah, and it never occurred.
But I've seen multiple people have these conversations and even write about things like this online, and they approach it from this wondrous sense of like, where did all our time go?
Yeah.
Now we still work 40 hours a week, or we're working harder than ever, so much for the promised benefits of technology.
Yeah.
They don't understand that it's self-inflicted, that we're choosing to spend more money and that's where it's going, that we're forced to work longer or work the same amount of hours because we want to have a more expensive lifestyle than people had 50 years ago.
Yeah.
That point seems lost on people.
Yeah, it is. It's completely lost. But that's exactly what's happened. Society has become far more productive and far more efficient. But instead of channeling that productivity and efficiency into taking more time off, we've just channeled it into more and more wants and desires and consumer goods.
It's not a mystery.
No, it's not a mystery at all. Not to me, anyway.
Oh, we just solved it. We just solved the mystery.
Oh, okay. That's it. We should write a paper.
A research paper. All right, let's kick it on to the next one.
Yes.
So I like this one. I actually heard this not too long ago. 5 people are just pretending to be happy. They are deluding themselves. But they're forced to spend zero money so that they don't have to go back to work.
Dave.
This is a bit strange, Pat. People are somehow convinced that there are groups of people in the FIRE movement that are deluding themselves into thinking that they are content with their lives and are forced to spend $0 so that they don't have to work. So essentially, you're telling someone, oh no, I enjoy my life. And then they're telling you, no, 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 that can't be right. You're obviously lying because you don't spend enough money to live a good life. Really? Do people really think that?
That is what people think. Which is, of course, nonsense. I was saving money before I'd even heard of FIRE.
FIRE wasn't even a term when I was working.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of embedded assumptions here. Front of mind is you need to spend money to be happy. And if you're not spending money, you can't be happy.
It costs X number of dollars to live a good life.
Yeah. Do we even have to...
I don't know.
Do we have to give this credence by even mentioning it?
Even just thinking about it logically for like 30 seconds will quickly tell you that this is absolute rubbish.
Oh, this is such nonsense.
Even if we dial down our spending massively, we live in such a good country at such a prosperous time in history that even a very simple modern life is pretty damn incredible compared to the rest of the world and compared to how people live throughout history.
I've written about this at least once or twice. Yeah.
Me too. But it doesn't go away, though. There's still this assumption that more consumption equals better life equals more happiness.
Look, I think if you were in Australia living right now, the chances are for like 99% of people, and certainly almost 100% of people who are listening to this now, that you are living in the top 0.01% quality of lives that have ever been able to be lived. We live in this magical modern time, which is just so abundantly good in Australia that it's almost impossible to make an argument otherwise. If you actually look back on how other people live and how people have lived in history, like our lives today are better than what a royalty's life would have been 100 years ago. And it's crazy to think otherwise.
We seem to have no ability or to have lost the ability to put things in perspective. We just get stuck. Like you said earlier, we just get stuck on the details of these little things in day-to-day life, and we forget about the bigger picture of what's happening over time, what things were like previously, what things are like in the rest of the world, and we just lack the ability to put things in perspective.
It's insane. It's so, without being rude or anything, it's abysmal. If you honestly think that, then you're a little human being that needs to learn a bit more about life. I don't want to generalize too much. I realize there are exceptions. I am generalizing based for the majority of people. Please don't come to me and tell me about the exceptions, because there are, of course, exceptions. But for the vast majority of us here today, we live amazing, modern, abundant lives that are so safe and so healthy. Would have been impossible to imagine even 100 or 200 years ago. It would seem like we are from outer space to people from that time. How good.
And that
we
we've
have
hit
it.
The jackpot completely.
Oh yeah, for sure. That's the thing.
And imagine if people had this little looking glass they could look through from the 1800s and see people, you know, in 2020, and how imagine they would be perplexed at how we are
whinging about
it. How we struggle to be like anything but grateful for the way the world is.
Yeah. So
and the living conditions that we have.
Yeah. Anyway, let's stop giving this point any more time.
Bananas. Let's move on.
Yeah, let's move on. I've had it.
What about the point that the whole idea of early retirement is ridiculous, and that 50 years of free time and not working is 50 years of retirement is absurd. And there's obviously only so much golf and Netflix you can enjoy.
Yeah, okay. So maybe we have to redefine this for a moment. When Dave says retirement and when Pat says retirement, we're not talking about playing bingo and playing golf all day. All we're actually talking about is retirement from mandatory full-time work in unfulfilling jobs or roles or very concrete demands on your life, I'll say, for lack of a better vocabulary right now.
I think it's just that this point comes from just a fundamental misunderstanding of what the point of financial independence is.
Yeah.
They think it's because we have this, like, we're allergic to work. We hate work and we just want to escape it.
Well, okay. And I think part of our problem is we have the same word for full-time employment by an employer that we have for completing productive things. And that word is work, right? So this is where I think the fundamental problem is. We use the same word for these two, what I consider very different things. So when we're talking about retirement, we're talking about not having your day-to-day work and day-to-day life dictated by an outside force that is very demanding of your time and reduces your flexibility in life to such a great extent that it becomes quite undesirable to be in that position. I'm not talking about stopping work or stopping productivity.
Yeah, it's not about, it's the same for me. It's not about not doing anything. It's about having the freedom to choose what you do with your time. And that includes productive things, because if you don't plan to do anything productive, you're probably not going to have an enjoyable life.
Not at all. But it's also...
So it's not about that at all.
No, but it's also like, what do you say about stay-at-home parents that aren't doing a full-time job or aren't on full-time employment? Are they absurd as well? Are they not being productive and doing actual real work? No one would ever say that. No one would be stupid enough to say that, right? Of course, they're still there. They're still working. They're still being productive. It's just, again, we're using this same word to describe these two very different things. No, like, we're not going to stop work. We're not good in the way I define work. We're not going to stop being productive. We're just stopping that work and productivity being dictated to us in how we want to do it, to what extent we want to do it, how often we need to do it by some outside force, because we're trading our time for money.
And so in that way, you could argue that being financially independent gives people the ability to do their best work.
Oh.
Or their most important work to them, you know what I mean? Depending on what is going to be meaningful for them in their own life.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it enhances your ability to work rather than is about avoiding work.
Oh, yeah.
It's the opposite.
And you get to do work while avoiding all of the nonsense and the crap that surrounds full-time employment.
Yeah.
For some reason, this whole 9-to-5 or 7-till-5 in our society still just hasn't gone away. Like, it's still here. Like, the normal job hours are 9-to-5. Or in my industry, it's from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m, right? So 10-hour workdays. And this is just like a leftover part of work culture from the days when we all made widgets in factories. And the amount of hours you put in equated quite linearly to the amount of widgets you produced, right? I can say with 100% certainty that when I take a bit more time to sleep in the morning, the rest of my day is so much more productive than if I try and get into work before 7 a.m. and leave after 5 p.m. Because again, like, when you're having your hours dictated to you, you can't do what is actually what's best for you and what will make you most productive. You just have to follow the damn rules.
Follow this robotic preset set of circumstances.
Yeah, which is stupid. It's so stupid. But I'm sort of thankful that I'm starting, again, people think that when you're a professional, you're like this fat cat smoking cigars and telling people what to do. Just, again, it's nonsense. It's like, professionals have worked so hard and so long sometimes, it's unbelievable. And for the first part of their career, it's on such low salaries that it almost becomes comical. I am now at 32 years old, just starting for the first time in my life to get an ability to sort of around the edges decide what times I'm allowed to work. And I still have to be there for long hours, but now I'm sort of getting a bit more freedom around when I get to start and when I get to finish for the first time. And I can tell you now, I'm becoming even more productive at work because I'm not forcing myself into this rigid schedule that doesn't agree with my body's natural rhythms.
Yeah, cool. Should we do a bit of a summary of the points that we've discussed today?
Wait, you missed one. Dave, fire is just running away from work.
Oh, I missed one.
If you don't like your job, if you don't like your job, get a different one.
Yes. Good one. I missed that. So, I don't know. Is FIRE running away from work? I don't think so. I mean,
running away from full-time employment.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that some people who are on this type of journey are hoping that FIRE will kind of fix their life in a way, or make FIRE itself will make them happy, but that's not really the case. Like, if you genuinely hate your work and you don't like your role or whatever, definitely look for something else in a different industry or a different position or whatever. But FIRE itself won't actually fix your life. It will just give you the ability to live a better life, one that you can control and design by yourself. FIRE is not necessarily running away from work at all. I think we've just covered how most people plan to be productive in their own way after retiring.
Yeah, and that productivity will take many different forms. But yeah, again, if I can just separate work into what, you know, the two different meanings that I want to call it. FIRE is running away from work, or just, you know, productivity at home, or just doing other sorts of work that you like to do, then no, absolutely not. It's just going to give you more options. Perhaps if someone is thinking of doing absolutely nothing, then they're going to have a real hard time of it. But if we want to say that FIRE is running away from full-time employment being dictated to you, then maybe that's correct.
That's fine. Yeah.
I suppose I'm not going to argue that. It's like, yeah, I don't want my work days continuously dictated to me for the rest of my life. Because it's a bit depressing. I want to be able to choose exactly how to spend my time.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And then people would say, oh, maybe you just need a new job with, you know, different people, different role, different industry. But that doesn't get at the crux of the problem. Yeah. Because you're still having your days and your demands dictated to you. And you often will have to still continue to do things that you don't necessarily agree with, or, you know, work to a rhythm that you don't necessarily want to work to.
And I guess what's happening is that you're trading your week away for money. And once you don't need that money anymore, why would you trade away your week if it's something that you don't actually love doing or wouldn't do for free? You don't need extra money. You can then choose to opt out of that trade of hours for dollars.
And I mean, exactly how many people out there wouldn't change something about their work if they won the lottery tomorrow? Like, really, there might be a tiny proportion of people that would continue to work 60 hours a week doing their full-time employment. But the vast majority of people, they would change at least something, you know, change to 4 days a week, more flexible working arrangements, start their own business, stop work for a bit, take more holidays. I think it's absurd to think that all of us have to be or are in jobs that we absolutely love and we'd absolutely continue doing exactly the same if we'd found that we had the money not to do them exactly the same. So in summary, we'll just go through some of these criticisms and our summarized rant responses. So FIRE is actually possible for the vast majority of people. It's possible for anyone who can save money. And so all that changes is sort of different scales and time frames around saving and how long it'll take to reach FIRE. Of course, that also depends on whether you have children, how early you started, etc. But it's definitely possible for most people. Number two, how you decide to pay for your housing shouldn't really affect how quickly, whether you can FIRE or not. What it comes down to is how much you spend on housing. And you can overspend and underspend whether you decide to buy a house or rent a house. But that's okay. You can still achieve FIRE as long as you are intelligent about it and you don't overspend on it. With sacrifice and getting to FIRE, you don't have to spend $0 to get to FIRE. You don't have to cut all the enjoyment out of your life. Trick is to prioritize what's important to you and spend money on those things. And be honest with yourself about what's important to you. Have an honest conversation with yourself about why you're spending so much money on certain things and whether you need to continue to spend money on those things in order to still have a fulfilling life. You'll find that you'll be able to cut away a lot of things and not cut away the enjoyment out of life.
And it's not even a case of, like, sometimes you don't even need to cut something out entirely. It's just you can still enjoy it, but maybe just do it a little bit less. Imagine all these different examples we could come up with right now of, okay, you enjoy these five different things and they're costing you quite a bit of money and sure that you get some enjoyment out of them, but maybe if you just dial it down a little bit, you still get to enjoy them while saving money in every category. I'm sure there's tons of examples we could think of. So really it's just about if you just moderate those a little bit, you can make a huge difference and you don't have to miss out on them altogether.
100% agree. Every category can be optimized if you really think about it and you really want to. I suppose we're saying the good life doesn't come from spending an arbitrary amount of money. Lower spending people can still have very good lives, and, you know, I think we can definitely prove that, Dave.
Unless we're just deluding ourselves.
Okay, it could be. So the point is not to avoid work, but live the life that you want to live. And that can include work and include various amounts of work, but it just happens on your terms. So it gives you the freedom to work on what matters to you without consuming all of your free time and little bits of your soul as you go along.
Yes. Okay, that's about it for today. So we hope you enjoyed the episode that we've got for you. If you did, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or share it with a friend so we can spread the message further. If you've got a question that you'd like us to answer on the show, you can email us at fireandchillpod@gmail.com. You can find more from us at our blogs, strongmoneyaustralia.com and lifelongshuffle.com. Have a great week and we'll talk to you soon.